Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Deadly weather hitting the South, and President Biden steps up to the podium. I'm Ali Velshi in for Shepard Smith. This is the news on CNBC. The president holds his first formal news conference.
Now I'll be happy to take your questions.
Facing reporters and fielding questions on everything from the border to whether he will run in 2024.
The answer is yes.
He has filed 10 counts of murder in the first degree.
The suspected gunman in the Colorado supermarket shooting makes his first court appearance. A former NRA lobbyist weighs in on what is actually possible when it comes to gun control laws. At least three dead as severe weather moves through the deep south, and the Storm Prediction Center warning of tornadoes moving at three times the typical speed. Plus, it could be weeks before one of the largest ships in the world is removed from the Suez Canal. Tonight, the threat to your store shelves and the options available to move it.
Live from CNBC, the facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith.
Good evening. President Biden making plenty of headlines during his first solo news conference with reporters. He announced he's doubling his COVID vaccine goal and is now promising 200 million shots in arms within his first 100 days. The president also told reporters he is planning to run for re-election. He blasted Republican efforts to restrict voting in dozens of states, calling it un-American and worse than Jim Crow. The president said it's unlikely the U.S. will be able to pull all troops out of Afghanistan by the May 1st deadline set by the Trump administration. But immigration took center stage at the news conference. The president spent most of the time defending his immigration policies as the U.S. faces a growing number of migrants at the southern border and an unprecedented number of children in U.S. custody.
If an unaccompanied child ends up at the border, we're just going to let him starve to death and stay on the other side. No previous administration did that either, except Trump. I'm not going to do it. All the policies that are underway were not helping at all. Did not slow up the amount of immigration. Rolling back the policies of separating children from their mothers, make no apology for that.
President Biden promised to give reporters more access to border facilities housing migrant children, where there have been reports of overcrowding and poor conditions, but he would not say when that will happen. I want to bring in Caitlin Dickerson. She's a staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers immigration as her beat. Caitlin, good to see you. The president is getting flack for the situation at the border. Did he help clear it up today when he talked about immigration at his press conference?
I think what President Biden tried to do was explain that really what he's done is try to restore, and not even fully, but just partially restore the status quo before President Trump took office. You know, what's happening now at the border is all kind of a blur because of the impact of the coronavirus pandemic, and that which allowed President Trump to put into place the most restrictive policy of his administration to really seal the border, something that he tried to do for 4 years and was able to do at the very end because of the pandemic. So now there's this perception that, you know, what's called Biden's immigration policies are, you know, allowing people into the country, when really what I think he was trying to clarify is that, you know, what he did was give people access to refugee protections, which have existed in some form since after World War II. Congress codified them into law in the 80s. But it's hard for people, because the changes happened so quickly, I think, to really grapple with that.
What does the president need to do to sort of calm the political waters around this? He's trying to deal with a problem that he says he inherited. What does he have to do to sort of stop this from becoming a major political rift in his first under 100 days in office?
Well, one of the biggest things that sticks out to me here is that I think we're forgetting, and perhaps he may try to remind people, that actually Congress is responsible for passing immigration laws. So, you know, President Trump really hijacked this issue. And as we all know, his Justice Department lawyers were in court basically from the first weeks of his administration all the way till the very end, defending his immigration policies, often unsuccessfully, right? Because they were running afoul of the existing immigration law. it's the existing immigration law that's created the situation we have now at the border. For most Central Americans who are coming to the United States, their only legal option is to pursue asylum, which requires this process of arriving at the southern border, requesting protection, and being processed into these overfull facilities. And so unless another option, another route opens up for them, that's going to continue. And the most difficult thing for the Biden administration to explain is that it really is up to Congress to make that change.
It's a big question to ask you, but what does a viable solution look like to you?
So in the short term, one question that I've asked three administrations now is, if you feel the facilities along the border are insufficient, why aren't new ones being built? And what officials often tend to tell you, they want to say on background or off the record, is that, that they don't want to build those big facilities because they feel like it will sort of send a message of welcoming and encourage even more people to come. But if you don't expand the facilities, you're going to see those overcrowded conditions that have existed since, 2012 now. And then more broadly, going back to Congress, I think it really is up to Congress to make a meaningful and lasting change that's going to prevent these kinds of conditions from popping up periodically as these surges happen. It's a very tall order, but I do think it's something Congress would need to get started on to really see a change.
It's complicated, but you do a great job of making it clear for us. Caitlin, thanks as always. Caitlin Dickerson is a staff writer at The Atlantic. She covers immigration. President Biden accused Republicans of abusing the Senate filibuster and said he strongly supports changing the rule if the GOP uses it to block his agenda. CNBC's senior White House correspondent Kayla Tausche now. Kayla, good evening. There's a lot that the president is looking to push through Congress.
There is. There's quite a bit, Allie, and a number of new issues confronting the Biden administration are beginning to challenge the president's campaign promises for the top spot in what is becoming a limited legislative queue, now stacked with immigration reform, gun control, infrastructure, and voting rights legislation that aims to reverse state efforts that could limit Democrats' turnout in future elections. Biden said that last goal had particular urgency.
What I'm worried about is how un-American this whole initiative is. It's sick. It's sick. Deciding in some states that you cannot bring water to people standing in line waiting to vote. Deciding that you're going to end voting at 5 o'clock when working people are just getting off work. Deciding that there will be no absentee ballots under the most rigid circumstances.
Democrats for the People Act would make no excuse absentee ballots a right and would federalize much of a state's handling of a presidential election. It stands no chance in the Senate, where it needs support from 60 senators to override the minority's veto power and move past debate, otherwise known as the filibuster. The number of times senators have filed to hold up a bill reached a record last Congress. Mr. Biden had suggested reforming that process to make it harder. Today, he said he'd go beyond reform if there's complete lockdown, but declined to say how far he'd go.
It's been abused from the time it came into being by an extreme way in the last 20 years. Let's deal with the abuse first.
You're moving closer to eliminating the filibuster. Is that correct?
I answered your question.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has said everything is on the table. Allie?
Kayla, the president made some news today on a topic that I was a bit surprised came up so early in his term.
He did. He was asked multiple times, Allie, whether he intended to run for re-election in 2024. This in the wake of a book that has new revelations that he originally floated to his advisors being a one-term candidate. They advised him against that. But today he said he does plan to run, said he expected to have the vice president on his ticket. And when asked why he hadn't set up a re-elect effort as his predecessor had, he said, "My predecessor needed to." Allie?
Kayla, good to see you. Thank you for joining us this evening. Kayla Tausche at the White House. Well, beyond Capitol Hill and the border, President Biden has critical foreign policy issues facing America in his first 100 days. The president says he's made it clear to Chinese leader Xi Jinping that the United States is not looking for a confrontation with Beijing, and he urged Americans to recognize the need to outcompete the authoritarian country.
We're going to invest in medical research, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes, the things, industries of the future, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, biotech, and we're going to make real investments. China is out-investing us by a long shot because their plan is to own that future.
Now, as for two ballistic missile launches by North Korea into the Sea of Japan today, President Biden says it's a clear violation of international law and there will be consequences.
We're consulting with our allies and partners, and there will be responses if they choose to escalate. We will respond accordingly.
Another top national security concern is Afghanistan. Under an agreement brokered by the Trump administration, the plan was to have U.S. troops out of the country by May 1st. The president says that's unlikely, but he can't picture troops on the ground there past this year. Well, the suspected gunman in the Boulder, Colorado mass shooting made his first appearance in court today. He was in a wheelchair, presumably because he was shot in the leg. The defense attorney asked the judge for more time to, quote, fully assess the suspect's mental illness, but she did not specify what kind of mental illness he might have. Right now, the suspected shooter is facing 10 counts of first-degree murder, and the district attorney said he's planning to file even more charges. Now, the deputies who wheeled the suspect in had black bands across their badges in honor of the police officer who was killed in the shooting. I want to bring in Richard Feldman. He's a former NRA lobbyist. He's the president of the Independent Firearms Owner Association. Richard, good to see you again. Thank you for being with us today. You've seen this play out before. There are shootings and there are conversations about what to do, particularly about the prevalence of this type of weapon out there. What's your reaction?
Well, there are two bills that have already passed the House, and I think it would probably be in the interests of the administration to focus on what's on the table now. After Newtown, I remember President Obama kind of brought everything on the table and ended up with nothing. The background check legislation on commercial transfers of firearms is largely supported by the firearms community, as long as that's where it goes. The more complicated you get, the more guns that are affected, well, the better that would really end up being only for those who want to see nothing happen or use it as a political gimmick for fundraising.
So when you look at some of the things, as you say, that are on the table, there is background checks for commercial transactions. There is the idea of these red flag laws where police can temporarily seize weapons until someone can demonstrate that they're entitled to them. Both of those actually have fairly widespread support. You're talking about other things. When you say if you put too much on the table, you're not going to get it. What are the things that are non-starters for the gun community?
Well, you start talking about semi-automatic rifles or pistols, guns that are commonly owned by tens of millions of Americans. The administration is picking a fight that it's likely to lose and one that prevents anything intelligent and meaningful from happening. That would certainly be one of them.
Sorry, Richard, I didn't mean to interrupt you. The truth is, even with things like background checks, which are widely supported, is it likely that something like that could get by the United States Senate? Virtually nothing gets through the United States Senate these days.
Well, with a 50-50 Senate, clearly I think Senator Manchin is really in the driver's seat in terms of being that 50th vote. But there's probably a couple Republicans, if it's crafted carefully enough, that would also consider supporting it.
Let me ask you about the NRA, because often you and I have talked about the power of the NRA. The NRA is a much weaker and more troubled organization than it's been in the last couple of years. What's the force on that side that isn't the NRA? Has something taken its place?
Well, in some ways, the power of the NRA was both exaggerated and the power really has never been in the leadership. The power has always been the membership and gun owners. And with the internet these days, You don't really need that strong gun rights group in Washington as long as it's various groups, and there are hundreds of them, are communicating that message to millions and millions of American voters who in turn are reaching out and talking to their elected officials. That's what we want to see happen in a democracy.
Richard, good to see you again. Thank you for joining us. Richard Feldman is the former NRA lobbyist. He's the president of the Independent Firearms Owners Association. As always, thanks for your time. Areas of the Deep South remain under threat from a series of fast-moving storms. After this break, we're going to go live to Alabama, where a possible tornado left a deadly path of destruction. And defunding the police, an issue so polarizing, it was asked of every potential juror in the George Floyd case. Tonight, where does police reform stand in Minneapolis? And as New York becomes the latest state to okay recreational pot use, how is representation for women growing along with that industry?
The facts. The truth. The news with Shepard Smith. Back in 60 seconds.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. With over 350 million global monthly visitors, Indeed's matching engine helps you find quality candidates fast. You get to ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. It's not just about hiring faster, though. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Don't search. Match with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Weather alert. Severe storms and destructive tornadoes rolling through the South tonight with deadly consequences. Authorities in Calhoun County, Alabama report at least three people were killed there. More than 30 million people from Louisiana to some areas in Pennsylvania are at risk. Forecasters say the severe storms will also bring large hail and powerful winds. Take a look at this drone video. A tornado left a trail of destruction in Pelham, Alabama. It's about 20 miles south of Birmingham. No reports of anyone hurt there. Governor Kay Ivey has issued a state of emergency as officials urge people to stay alert and know where their closest shelters are. NBC's Kerry Sanders is live in Pelham. The damage that we're looking at, Kerry, is significant. How bad are these storms?
Well, they are very powerful, especially for those who are in the path. You can see the damage behind me. This is really round one that you see behind me. We are currently in round two of these storms that will go well into the darkness tonight. The conditions are just prime for these tornadoes. And so what we have are powerful tornadoes, and right now what appears to be what you would call a long-track tornado on the ground right now. That means it will be on the ground potentially for 20 or more miles. It initially touched down in Centerville, Alabama. It is moving in a direction ultimately towards Tennessee, Georgia. You know, you can't really predict an exact route. This is not like it's following an interstate. But what we do know is because of radar, we can determine how high some of the debris is going. And the debris in the radar loops is showing that it's going up to 20,000 feet. It'll be too early to say what the F force of this tornado will be. But when you see the debris that high, we're talking about one that's probably in excess of an F2, maybe like an F3 or more. For the survivors here in Pelham, it's been an ordeal of course, but they're very happy to have survived. This is what several of the survivors told me after the tornado had passed.
I could hear the noise, and I actually went up the steps, got in my apartment, closed the door, and everything started shaking and rattling. I went running into the bathtub, covered myself up, And then it just passed over.
You got in there
in a closet.
And what?
In a closet.
You got in the closet.
And put mixing bowls on our head. Metal
it worked.
Mixing bowls, yeah. And we heard it, and I said, oh my God, it's gone.
Yeah, you heard that right. Mixing bowls on her head, but it worked. She got out unscraped tonight because when darkness hits, there will still be a tornado threat. Emergency officials are encouraging people to sleep with their cell phones by their beds so that if the alert goes off, they can take defensive action, Allie.
A tornado after dark is one of the most dangerous things people will ever experience. Carrie, you and I have done a lot of storms together, so I know you know your way around it, but stay safe, my friend. Carrie, for us down in Alabama, Pelham, Alabama. Texas officials raising the death toll from last month's massive winter storm. At least 111 Texans lost their lives following one of the worst power outages in U.S. history. That's nearly double the initial tally, according to the state's Department of Health. The majority of the deaths are associated with hypothermia. Officials say the death toll could rise as they continue their investigation. Well, the nation's largest police force is cracking down on bias attacks targeting the Asian community. The NYPD today unveiled a new approach. It involves increased outreach and added layers of enforcement. Chief Rodney Harrison says undercover detectives will be deployed to Asian American neighborhoods throughout the city. The NYPD is also meeting with residents and business owners in large Asian communities. Many of them have been reluctant to contact police, even if they've been the victim of a crime. Officials say the NYPD is actively investigating or has solved 12 anti-Asian bias assaults so far this year. At this time last year, no such crimes had been reported. Well, the impeachment investigation into New York Governor Andrew Cuomo now includes the allegations that he gave his family special access to COVID testing in the early days of the pandemic. The claims, first reported by the Albany Times Union, says that testing was often done in the comfort of their homes and by top health officials. State troopers then rushed the tests to labs and moved them to the front of the line. And it wasn't just family. Also reportedly getting special treatment, a Port Authority executive, the head of the MTA, and state legislators. Cuomo's office telling the Times Union that this is, quote, a little bit distorted with, like, a devious intent. All of this was being done in good faith to trace the virus, end quote. All this happened back in March of last year when COVID tests were nearly impossible to get. Well, high tech in the hot seat, the heads of Google, Twitter, and Facebook facing Capitol Hill questions. The focus, what role did the sites play in the Capitol Hill riots and spreading lies about the pandemic? And a heavily armed trip to the grocery store lands one man in handcuffs.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Chrissy Teigen, the unofficial mayor of Twitter, has quit the platform. The model and TV personality wrote yesterday that being on Twitter no longer serves her as positively as it does negatively, so it's time to call it quits. Later on Instagram, she clarified that it wasn't Twitter's fault, emphasizing that the platform does all it can to combat relentless bullying. But on Capitol Hill today, lawmakers seem to disagree with that premise, blaming the CEOs of Twitter, Facebook, and Google for allowing disinformation and hateful and extremist content to spread, especially in the aftermath of the January 6th riots. CNBC's senior congressional correspondent, Ilan Moy, live in Washington. Ilan, good evening. How is Congress trying to connect misinformation to money?
Well, Ali, it always comes back to the bottom line. Democrats argue that divisive content drives engagement, and that means these companies have a financial incentive to leave it up. This testy exchange between the CEOs and Congresswoman Robin Kelly pretty much sums it up.
Do each of you acknowledge that your company has profited off harmful misinformation, conspiracy theories, and violent content on your platform? Just a yes or no.
No, that's not our business.
I don't think we profit from it. I think it hurts our service.
Certainly not our intent.
Since you all said no, can you please provide to me in writing how you managed to avoid collecting revenue from ads either targeted by or served on such content?
Now, Republicans were on the attack, too, honing in on the potential harm to kids from cyberbullying to exploitation.
But do you know what convinced me big tech is a destructive force? It's how you've abused your power to manipulate and harm our children. Your platforms are my biggest fear as a parent.
Now, the CEOs defended themselves by saying that they're ramping up the fight against misinformation and hateful content, but there's no way they'll catch every problematic post, and they admitted that they're going to make mistakes. But lawmakers have heard that song before, Ali, and they made it very clear. If these CEOs can't police their own platforms, Washington will do it for them.
Elon, thank you. Good to see you again. Elon Moy in Washington. Well, a big loss for the officer in the Eric Garner case, and police arrest a heavily armed man at a supermarket on this CNBC trip coast to coast. Georgia. These are the weapons police say they confiscated from a man who allegedly walked into a public supermarket heavily armed. Happened yesterday in Atlanta. Witnesses say they spotted 22-year-old Rico Marley in a bathroom stall with an AR-15 rifle propped up against the wall. At the time of his arrest, authorities say Marley had six guns and body armor. New York. The NYPD officer fired over Eric Garner's death is not getting his job back. A state appeals court today agreed with the city judge, saying Daniel Pantaleo acted recklessly when he put Garner in a chokehold during a 2014 arrest. The NYPD fired Pantaleo for using the banned chokehold. He sued to be reinstated and to get his pension back. Pantaleo's lawyer says his client is obviously disappointed with today's decision. Alabama, a surprise reunion between a 13-year-old girl and her mom. Petty Officer First Class Katrina Rozier has been deployed for 7 months. She was supposed to return home to Daphne just outside of Mobile later this week, but her daughter, Tamaria, was so happy to see her walk into that classroom. Tamaria says this is her mom's third deployment with the Navy. Well, the new normal in college. Rutgers University has announced if you want to return to campus in the fall, you'd better roll up your sleeve. But can a public college make a vaccine mandate stick? And the show must go on, and it will. The mayor of New York on when he expects the curtains to rise on Broadway and what it'll take to get there. Hiring is finally starting to pick up. That's what's topping CNBC's On the Money. First-time claims for unemployment insurance fell last week to 684,000. That's more than 12% lower than the week before, and it's the first time claims were below 700,000 during the pandemic. 30 million Americans are finally getting their stimulus checks after a brief delay. The Social Security Administration announced it submitted payment information this morning to the IRS. The agency's commissioner blamed the delay on the terms outlined in the American Rescue Plan. Pepsi and Peeps are teaming up to launch a marshmallow-flavored soda. You will not find it on store shelves. It's only available through a social media promotion that ends on March 31st. And on Wall Street, the Dow up 199, the S&P up 20, the NASDAQ was up 16. I'm Ali Velshi in for Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's bottom of the hour. Here's what's making the news. During his first formal news conference, President Biden announced his administration's new vaccine goal.
That's right, 200 million shots in 100 days. I know it's ambitious, twice our original goal.
So far, 116 million shots have gone into American arms since his inauguration. That's according to the CDC. And the eligibility floodgates are opening. California, Florida, North Carolina, and Connecticut announced today that they are on target to beat the administration's May 1st deadline for all adults to be eligible for a vaccine. That brings the number up to 30 states. CNBC's Kayla Tausche reports this comes after Tuesday's call between governors and the White House, in which governors were told to expect a significant increase of Johnson & Johnson's single-dose vaccine in the coming weeks. But with more supply and eligibility expanding, the thorny issues of requiring vaccines is now coming into the forefront. Today, Rutgers became one of the first major universities to require its students to have a vaccine before returning to campus in the fall. CNBC's Meg Terrell now. Meg, can Rutgers and others actually mandate this?
Yeah, Ali, it depends who you ask. But two lawyers we spoke with said, yes, universities can require students to get COVID vaccines in order to come to on-campus classes. And they don't expect Rutgers will be the only university to do it.
To prevent having to close down again, it makes a lot of sense to require vaccines as that. I'll also add that this isn't the first vaccine that universities have mandated.
Now, Rutgers said it will add the COVID-19 vaccine to those required of its students, a list that also includes measles, mumps, and rubella. The university said students may request exemptions for medical or religious reasons and said it's not requiring faculty and staff to get the vaccine, though it's strongly encouraging it. Rutgers told us that's because the positivity rate is much higher among students. Now, for their part, students on campus today said they were excited about what widespread vaccination could mean for the fall.
It'll be good that everyone will be vaccinated on campus, definitely a lot safer. And I'm just more excited for fall semester.
So hopefully sophomore year can be a lot like a real college experience.
I'm ready to have more people out here and get to enjoy normal life again.
But there was some backlash to Rutgers' tweet online, with one person responding, quote, I'm not forcing my kids to get a vaccine that's not fully tested yet. And there are questions about what it means that the vaccines have emergency use authorization and not yet full approval. Law professor Glenn Cohen says he doesn't believe that makes a legal difference.
It matters a lot for the PR, but when it comes to the legal matter, there's nothing in the statute that says you cannot have vaccination mandates applying to an EUA.
And the vaccines could be fully approved by the middle of the year, analyst Jeff Porges at Wall Street firm Leerink says, although all we spoke with agreed there could still be legal challenges to vaccine requirements down the road. Allie?
Meg, thanks for your reporting. Good to see you tonight. Meg Terrell. Broadway, dark for more than a year now, could return this fall. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio promising to help theaters open by September.
This is going to be a year to turn things around. It's time to raise the curtain and bring Broadway back.
The mayor announced he'll be putting resources toward the effort, including making sure theater workers get the vaccine. CNBC's Leslie Picker live on Broadway tonight. Leslie.
Hey, Allie, you know that famous line from the musical Hamilton, I'm not throwing away my shot? Well, that's soon going to have more than one meaning here on Broadway. In about 4 weeks' time, the city plans to build a dedicated vaccine venue for theater workers here in Times Square. The jabs will be for eligible theater workers, and the site will be staffed by those in the community who need employment. They also plan to build pop-up testing sites near theaters like this one, which used to host The Lion King. And the city is developing plans to manage crowds before and after shows. Now, the details, they're kind of scarce at this point, but it's a welcome bit of good news for an industry that's been dark and in the dark for about a year now. That's according to Kate Schindel, who runs the Union for Professional Actors and Stage Managers. She says she's been pushing the city for a plan.
Sometimes it can feel like screaming into a fan. You know, you don't know if anybody's hearing or digesting or implementing anything. And then suddenly something happens that makes it clear that people have been listening.
By one measure, Broadway accounts for nearly 100,000 jobs and contributes $15 billion annually to the local economy. Those jobs and that economic benefit disappeared when Broadway went dark. Despite the ongoing talks, though, about reopening Broadway, significant hurdles remain. For one, tourism. The bulk of ticket sales come from visitors to New York. Also, safety protocols like updating HVAC systems. And lastly, capacity constraints. Theater producers and owners already run very, very tight budgets, and they won't be willing to bring the curtain up unless they can fill pretty much all of those seats, Allie.
Leslie, I appreciate you working, not throwing away my shot into the newscast tonight. Good to see you, Leslie Picker, on Broadway.
Thank you.
Well, the trial for the ex-cop charged in the Breonna Taylor shooting will remain in Louisville for now. Today, a judge denied the motion to move the trial, which is set for August. Brett Hankison's attorney had argued the pretrial publicity put his client in danger and that a change of venue would help protect Hankison. But the judge maintained that the publicity had been far-reaching. She said the, quote, prudent thing to do, end quote, is to try to see seat, an impartial jury first. If that can't happen, then she'd consider moving the trial elsewhere. Hankison is not charged directly with Breonna Taylor's death. He's facing three counts of wanton endangerment for firing into her neighbor's apartment. Hankison has pled not guilty. Well, after the death of George Floyd, the Minneapolis City Council pledged to dramatically change its police department, defund it entirely, they vowed at the time, and replace it with a public safety system. But now, 8 months later, critics say the meager reforms that followed have amounted to virtually nothing. Here's NBC's Shaquille Brewster.
It started with a promise in a park.
To end policing as we know it.
Minneapolis City Council pledging radical reform less than 2 weeks after the police killing of George Floyd.
A majority of council members, of city council members on stage supporting that idea to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department.
A headline-grabbing commitment.
To defund the police.
Still unfulfilled today.
What has happened since that day?
We took 5% of the mayor's proposed budget that was for the police, and we've allocated it towards other programming.
There has been progress. The police chief announced new use of force guidelines for officers, including a ban on neck restraints. After much political pressure, Mayor Jacob Frey agreed to nearly $8 million in police budget cuts, shifting the money to violence prevention and mental health response initiatives. And this month, the council resubmitted a proposal to amend the city's charter, replacing the police department with a more holistic Department of Public Safety.
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want?
Now!
Incremental steps short of the promised radical reform.
Minneapolis City Council even said we were going to defund the police, and then they backed
out.
They backed out.
But do you think it satisfies the people who were in that park that day who saw it said defund the police?
And the truth is that I'm not satisfied. I think that we could make deeper investments.
But for some, even the conversation of defunding the police is dangerous.
You think this movement causes harm?
This movement, not think. Let's look at the facts. It has caused harm.
Across Minneapolis, homicide rates last year soared to multi-year highs, a pattern mirrored in other large cities. But this spike was met with a thinner police force. The department down nearly 200 officers since last year, the result of retirements, resignations, and more than 100 officers taking extended leave.
To defund the police right now is absolutely positively insane, and to me it was a gimmick when there were some other things that they could have implemented and got some of what they desired.
A battle that continues.
I want to ask them to reclaim their imagination and then ask them to dream of a public safety system that can keep folks safe and also not murder people.
A community divided over reforming the existing system or drastically recreating it.
And the Minneapolis City Council recently passed a measure that could put the question of whether or not to dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department to voters in November. Allie?
Shaquille Brewster for us in Minneapolis. It's now harder to vote in Georgia. The state's Republican governor today signing a restrictive new law. It limits early voting and it adds new voter ID requirements and it bans people from bringing food or water to voters who are waiting in lines. Republicans pushed for this in the wake of baseless claims of fraud in the 2020 election. Democrats and voting rights groups say this is classic voter suppression. A record settlement in a sexual abuse lawsuit, the University of Southern California agreeing to pay $852 million to more than 700 women who accuse a campus gynecologist of sexual abuse. Dr. George Tyndall worked at the school for nearly three decades. He faces 35 counts of criminal counts of sexual misconduct between 2009 and 2016. He's pleaded not guilty and is free on bond. Well, a country of more than 200 million people, the global epicenter of the pandemic, and now its healthcare system is on the verge of collapse. Coming up next, the dire reality of life in Brazil. And one of the busiest shipping routes in the world remains blocked every hour. Millions of dollars in goods delayed. So what are the options to get things flowing again? A massive cargo ship spending a third day stuck in Egypt's Suez Canal, clogging one of the busiest shipping routes in the world. Rescue crews now say it might take weeks to set it free. Today, multiple tugboats failed to dislodge the Ever Given. Officials say strong winds and a sandstorm knocked the ship off course. Shipping experts say the vessel's enormous size may have been a factor because the containers on deck can act as giant sails during windy conditions. All right, let me give you a sense of how big this ship is. Here's a comparison. The Evergreen is about 1,300 feet long. That is longer than the Eiffel Tower and almost as long as the Empire State Building. The situation not stopping armchair experts on Twitter from offering pop culture-inspired solutions. Why not just pivot like Ross from Friends? Or just keep backing in and out like Austin Powers? But beyond the laughs, this thing could pose a serious problem to the world's supply chain. NBC's Matt Bradley in Tel Aviv tonight to explain. Matt?
Yeah, Ali, I mean, we can't overstate the importance of this waterway. There have been wars that have been fought over the Suez Canal. And, you know, there's about $3 billion worth of goods that normally would traverse this canal every single day. About 50 different ships. And that's why this backup is causing some maybe more than 150 ships right now that are basically kind of in a holding pattern on either side of the canal. And that number is going to go up. Certainly some of those ships are going to start to be diverted around the Horn of Africa. But that adds about a week to that journey. In terms of what's being held up, it's just about everything. This is more than 10% of all global commerce passes through the Suez Canal. So we're talking about anything that comes out of Asia headed towards Europe or vice versa. So that includes oil. There are even some 40 tankers that include live animals and water. All of that, of course, can't really just sit in the middle of the ocean for all that much longer. And that's why there's such a frantic effort to try to get this ship unmoored and out of the Suez Canal so the traffic can resume again. Now, the latest that we're hearing is that there's been a salvage effort. They're trying to decide what to do. It really looks as though they're going to have to start unloading some of these goods in order to get that ship freed. But that is going to be a very sensitive and very delicate operation in order not to make a very bad situation even worse. Ali?
Matt Bradley, thank you. My friend Matt is in Tel Aviv watching this story closely. Sal Mercogliano now is a former merchant mariner. He's also an adjunct professor of the maritime industry policy at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. He's a professor as well at Campbell University. Sal, this is remarkable, some of the things that that Matt was just telling us about, including that backlog of ships, somewhere approaching 200 ships now. I assume nobody else is going into the Suez Canal while this blockage exists. But what happens with a backlog of ships? Can they back out? Can they turn around?
They actually had to pull three vessels out that were right behind the Ever Given. And so that was a clear sign that this process was going to take longer than they thought. Right now, the vessels are holding in place. There's going to be a decision whether or not to start routing around. One of the most ominous things we're seeing right now is the parent company, Evergreen, has started to route two of their vessels around Africa. That's telling us this may take a lot longer than they were initially expecting.
Let's talk about that. The Horn of Africa, the way ships used to travel before there was a Suez Canal, it is much longer. It costs much, much more in fuel. It affects arrival times. But the fact is, that's what some ships are doing right now. What does that do to the global supply chain?
Well, what you see right now is the global supply chain is in a state of flux. Goods are not moving through the Suez Canal. You're not moving the 50 vessels that typically move through the canal on a typical day. And if you have to go that extended route, you're talking about adding 3,500 miles on a route from Singapore to Rotterdam, talking about 12 to 14 days.
Wow.
And most importantly right now, the ports that were expecting to receive these vessels are not receiving these vessels. And you're going to have a situation very similar to what we're seeing in the U.S. right now with ships lined up off our ports because demand was pent up. In this case, supply is being held back.
Are we going to miss things? Are there going to be shelves that are going empty with stuff because of this?
Well, I think right now what you're seeing is fuel prices begin to spike up in Europe. You're going to start seeing consumer goods, e-commerce goods, goods for manufacturing. There may be production plants, automobile factories, for example, will have to shut down waiting to get parts. We don't live in a society today where we store a lot of parts. I go back to the situation we faced in early 2020 when all of a sudden there was no toilet paper. It's not that there was a shortage of toilet paper. There was a shortage of toilet paper
right
where you needed it.
Right. And when you need toilet paper, you need it with you. This canal was built in 1869. It was actually a remarkable technological leap forward. I would have guessed that there was good technology in place to unstuck a ship, but there isn't. We're looking at tugboats and little earth movers.
Well, the difficulty you have, Ali, is this vessel is so large. And again, at 1,300 feet, when she lost control, she's literally rammed her bow into Asia and she's put her stern ashore on Africa. And she's astride one of the most narrowest parts of the canal. And you have to be very careful in this position because the two ends of the vessel are resting on land and the middle is floating. You can't just merely begin offloading fuel and lightering the vessel because you have to worry about the vessel cracking and perhaps the worst fear of all, a catastrophic breaking of the vessel. So you have to be very careful in how you start maneuvering this vessel. In truth, the canal was built to accept these vessels. In 2015, the canal was expanded. Ironically, when the canal closed for 8 years during the Six-Day War, maritime shipping got big. It actually started to route around Africa. And in the process after that, Egypt has continually expanded their canal to try to get these ships back in. The most recent expansion was to fit these ultra-large container vessels.
Sal, thank you for your wisdom on this. What a remarkable story. Sal Mercogliano is a history professor at Campbell University and an adjunct professor at the of Maritime Industry Policy at the U.S. Merchant Marine. Thank you, sir. An entire country's health system is on the verge of collapse as we take a CNBC trip around the world. Brazil, officials confirming 300,000 COVID deaths. That's second only to the United States. In some cities, most ICUs are full with more than 500 people waiting for a bed and oxygen is running in short supply. All this as Brazil's president leaves it to local officials to require health measures like masks and social distancing. Iceland, incredible drone video capturing shots of lava bubbling in the crater of a volcano. It erupted near Reykjavik, and you can see bright red lava pouring from the crater down the side of the volcano. In order to capture all of this, the drone operator braved the snow and biked 4.5 miles to get close to the eruption. And Egypt, a couple launching a taxi service for animals only. They're offering rides to the vet's office or anywhere else they need to go. Perfect for pet owners who can't make time to accompany their pets. The husband drives the car while his wife keeps the animals company in the back seat and feeds them. The duo said they'd like to expand their service and launch an app soon. That is our CNBC trip around the world. Well, that invisible barrier that blocks women at work, it's called the glass ceiling. Well, how about a grass ceiling instead? Why the number of women in the cannabis industry is growing fast and why they say nothing is holding them back. And the NCAA apologized after being called out for the weak sauce weight room in its women's training facilities. After the break, Congress is saying that's not the only problem. Actress Jessica Walter has died, likely best known as the scheming matriarch of the Bluth family on Arrested Development. Walter first gained acclaim as the stalker in Clint Eastwood's Play Misty for Me. In a statement, Walter's daughter wrote of her mom, quote, a working actor for more than 6 decades. Her greatest pleasure was bringing joy to others through her storytelling, both on screen and off. A cause of death has not been released. Jessica Walter was 80. Well, New York could be just days away from legalizing marijuana. After years of failed attempts and disagreements, state lawmakers hashed it out, lighting the way for the multi-billion dollar industry to grow. New York would join 14 other states that allow recreational use, and the budding industry has also attracted tons of women. During the height of the pandemic, some even started their own business. CNBC's Frank Holland on women blazing their own path.
This is about 10 pounds of Super Lemon Haze. It really slaps. Fire product testing at about 28% THC.
A combination of high-end cannabis knowledge and hijinks is what you'll find at this female-focused adult-use cannabis dispensary.
Being a woman in the cannabis space is exhilarating.
Caroline Pino was pregnant when she and her mostly female staff opened STEM in suburban Boston during the pandemic.
We wanted to design a space that was like you were talking to your mom or your grandma or your sister over the kitchen table about cannabis.
The rapidly expanding cannabis industry is becoming more and more female focused, adding 77,000 new jobs in 2020. The majority were women.
Just another day in the neighborhood.
It's a chance for women to fast track their career.
A new report from cannabis staffing firm Banks finds women grew last year from 39% to 42% of the industry. Also, nearly half of workers have been in cannabis a year or less. That means unlike many other industries where women face barriers to advancement, Banks says there is no grass ceiling in cannabis.
They can work in the business for a couple years and be considered somebody with a lot of experience in cannabis.
Trella Technologies develops devices for indoor cannabis farming.
I looked at it and I said the best place to be is on the cultivation side.
Founder Aja Atwood went from an engineer to an entrepreneur in cannabis tech.
Because it's such a new industry, there's a lot of problems that need to be solved that have yet to be fixed. And women love, you know, we like to solve problems. We're really good at solving problems.
Demand is not a problem. STEM usually has lines before doors open. And in the U.S., legal sales are forecast to grow 40% this year to $24 billion.
It's a tremendous opportunity for me as a female entrepreneur to really put my stamp on a brand new industry right from its infancy. And I really think that women are the future of the cannabis industry.
And Banks says as the industry grows, there is a growing need for professionals like accountants, lawyers, even engineers like Aja Atwood. And that can be a way to enter the industry for women that don't want to completely change their careers. Ali?
Frank, great story. Thank you for joining us tonight, Frank Holland. Well, Congress is demanding answers from the NCAA over disparities between the men's and women's college basketball tournament. 37 House members wrote a letter to the NCAA president, Mark Emmert, asking for an explanation on several fronts, including why the women's weight room was so inferior to the men's and why less accurate COVID tests were used for women. The NCAA apologized for dropping the ball on the weight room and did upgrade it. However, it defended the use of the less accurate tests, saying there was no different risk in using them. Members of Congress asked for a response by April 2nd. And there are 50 seconds left on a race to the finish. At least five people are confirmed dead after tornadoes tore through Alabama. President Biden holding his first solo news conference. He defended his immigration policies as the U.S. faces a growing number of migrants at the southern border. Rutgers University is now requiring students to get the COVID vaccine if they want to attend the fall semester. And now you know the news. This Thursday, March 25th, 2021. I'm Ali Velshi in for Shepard Smith. You can catch me on my program on MSNBC Saturdays and Sundays from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern. Hope to see you then. But for now, it is time for Shark Tank on CNBC. Have a good night.
You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you. Like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.